Welcome to episode 207 of the 200 Churches Podcast.
I need to care deeply and passionately for the people that God puts around me. And yet at the same time, I need to not care about the shifting praise of those people, right?
Yeah.
I need to not have who I am as a person rooted on other people's opinion of me. I need it rooted in who God has made me to be. And if I can get really comfortable with who I am and my strengths and in my limitations, recognizing that I have a created self that God has formed, He made me that way, I need to be comfortable in my own skin. And the reality is when I do that, when I can get to a point where I'm not as clinging to the opinions of others, I actually can care more for those people. Yes.
Welcome to the 200 Churches Podcast, where every Wednesday we produce a fresh episode of ministry encouragement for pastors of small churches. Now here are two guys who, like you, serve in the trenches of small church ministry. The Siskel and Ebert of Ministry Podcasts, Jeff and Johnny.
This is the 200 Churches Podcast. My name is Johnny Craig, and I'm sitting across the table from the man in the striped pajamas.
Oh, they're not pajamas, Johnny. They look like pajamas.
It's a business shirt. It looks
just
like.
Because it's like the holidays, you think I'm hanging around in my pajamas.
Wow, striped. I thought it would be like a thing, a striped pajamas.
It's my own prison uniform.
Perfect.
I was a guard. Come on, you know what I
sure,
mean.
Sure, yeah, that's fine.
I was never a guard.
When
Don't
you
worry
were at UPS,
it.
Was there a guard shack?
At UPS, no.
No?
No, and crazy, 18 years later, after I left, yeah. I went back to visit.
Yeah.
Nothing had changed, and there still wasn't a guard shack.
That's ridiculous.
No, there's no guard shack.
Where I worked, there was a guard shack.
Well, yeah, because you were in the big city.
You had to show your ID.
I was in Scranton. Anyway, today, we've got Justin Irving and Andrew Gross.
Yes.
With us. We very rarely do we have two guests.
That's true.
They're talking about this thing that some of our listeners might be getting tired of us saying,
yeah.
Differentiation of self.
I'm tired of hearing us say
I'm kind of tired of it, but it's so important and it's connected
it really
to self-awareness,
yeah.
Right? Emotional intelligence, self-awareness, how to be with another group of people, whether or not you're the leader, actually. So they've written a book,
yep.
On differentiation of self as it relates to pastoral ministry.
Right.
So this is like the bullseye of what we've been talking about.
Right, yeah.
So the last time we talked about this, we were talking to Janine Brown.
Yep.
And she is a professor at Bethel Seminary in San Diego. She said to us, hey, I got this friend who's written this book with somebody else.
Yeah.
You should talk to him. This is the friend.
So many great things to say. You know, we've talked to big name people on this podcast, and I like to think of guys like Justin Irving as like the diamonds in the rough. Like, you haven't heard of him, but he has so much phenomenal content. Like, we're digging the pearls out of the oysters here. You know what I mean?
People around Bethel Seminary.
I mean this in a nice way.
Right.
Maybe it doesn't sound
have heard
good.
Of Justin.
Right, absolutely.
And he's been teaching. He's the director of their DMIN program.
Absolutely.
So he does an awful lot. But you're right. Most of the vast majority
right.
of our listeners would never have heard of
right.
him. Let's get right into it here. They talk about the book that they've written, and it hasn't been published yet, but we talk about the topic and
yeah.
the subject
yeah,
of
awesome.
The book. So here we go. It's good to have Andrew Gross and Justin Irving on the horn with us all the way from the North Country, Johnny, up there in Minnesota.
I bet you it's warmer where you are today than where we are today. What's the temperature for you guys right now?
-3.
Okay, ooh. Well, it's very similar then, actually.
I don't think it's that cold here,
you
is it?
Let me see. This I got it at 12 degrees, but with wind chill, I'm sure we're pushing negative something.
Oh, that's a significant difference, though.
It's cold out there.
You guys are up
in whooping us.
The North Country, and we want to welcome you. And guys, why don't you introduce yourselves to our listeners?
I'm Andrew Gross. I am a pastor at a local church here in the Twin Cities. It's a multi-ethnic church. I've been attending for over 25 years, but I've been the pastor there for the last, first I was the youth pastor. Now I'm sort of like, kind of like the associate pastor. That's not my title, but that's what I am.
Does that mean you do everything there that can be done?
Kind of.
Yeah.
Basically, yes.
That's what that means
whatever.
Here too.
Yeah. So, then I finished my MDiv at Bethel Seminary in 2012. I'm also a part-time writer and editor.
Oh, okay. What do you write and what do you edit?
You know what? I mostly help students who are working on their doctorates. Most of them, English is their second language, so they might be really brilliant, but they need a little help getting that final polish on things.
Sure.
So I help a lot of those people. And then I also help write books. I'm working on a few right now. And my main desire is to write books that will help equip Christian leaders, Christian pastors especially.
Very cool. So, very cool. You do ghostwriting for big names that can't admit that they didn't write their own book ever?
Or maybe grosswriting.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes, there you go. Wow.
I'm embarrassed. I'm sorry.
You can answer the question, Andrew.
Yes, I do some of that. Yes.
That's so cool. And there's a woman who lives in the town next to us, and she does that as well. And she wrote this book, and Glenn Beck's name is on the front. And I'm like, how does that work exactly? Like, what is this shtick that people are running? Anyway, we're going to need you to write our book for us, Andrew. We can't pay you, but we're excited to put our name on the front.
Oh, okay.
Note that this is the first time the name Glenn Beck has ever been uttered on the 200 Churches
podcast.
That's
like the biggest name. Like, she wrote a book, and that's the name on the... I think that's crazy, but whatever.
Okay, Justin.
Justin, how you doing?
Hey, I'm doing good. Keeping warm today up here in the tundra.
What do you do over there, Justin? You're in the Twin Cities?
I am, yeah. I live in the heart of Minneapolis. Family side, my wife Tasha and I have five kids. They keep us busy. From oldest being in high school on down to kindergarten. So we are active and chasing those kids around. It's a lot of fun. And I really appreciate the emphasis of your podcast, at least for the last probably 23 years. Our family has settled into churches that are around 200 or less. So that's really been a sweet spot for our family. So love the emphasis that you all have about trying to think through pastoral engagement in that context, and really appreciate it. I've been at Bethel for over 16 years. Served there as a professor teaching in the area of leadership. Lead our Doctor of Ministry program and get to hang out with people like Andrew. Andrew was my TA for a number of years, and just really have enjoyed working with him. We've known each other for about 8-9 years now,
yeah,
something like that.
Yeah.
Very cool. So Andrew was one of those snooty residential students. Is that what you're saying?
I wasn't residential, but I was pretty snooty. But we made up for it with Justin's a slave driver. So it was
perfect. I remember us in ministry slobs would come up to seminary, and sometimes there'd be residential students, and they looked at us with such disdain.
I was a
once a week 7 p.m. student, and they looked at me.
7 p.m. Okay.
Too,
so. Yeah, what's up with them? We're not academic enough. What is this? I don't know. Terrible.
Well, hey guys, it's so good to have you with us, and there are two particular reasons, and we're going to get to the first right now. And a few weeks ago, we talked to Dr. Janine Brown, and this big long phrase differentiation of self came up, and then I think it came up again when we talked to Ray Hollenbach. I think we talked about that a little bit. And then, Johnny, you and I did one together recently without a guest. Yep. Imagine that.
Where we admitted that we sometimes...
We're not differentiated?
We disagree with each other.
Oh, well, that's no big deal.
I mean, I'm always differentiated. I've never reacted in a moment anyway, but fully well.
See, I'm okay with all that because you know, I'm the senior pastor, so I get the easy role.
That's
but
funny.
Hey, so you guys, Justin, you and Andrew and somebody else have worked on a book that deals with that topic of differentiation of self as it relates to pastoral ministry, which is, I mean, that's like the bullseye of what we really want to talk about with our pastor friends today, because men and women out there who have never really heard of this before, they'll recognize it in their life and in their relationships as we talk about it. So you want to just introduce the concept of your book to us?
Yeah, you bet. It's written. We're still kind of shopping it around with publishers and all that. Still working on a title, but it's dealing kind of with the intersection of leadership resiliency and the concept of differentiation of self. So we really were asking the question, what helps leaders thrive over the long haul? So not just these sort of short spurts, but being able to be faithful and consistent and stick with things over the long haul in leadership and ministry. And at least we're persuaded the differentiation of self is really core to that. Leaders who get that are able to navigate conflict. They're able to engage people coming from different perspectives in a stable manner over the long haul. And those that lack it are sort of constantly trying to appease people or please people. And it really takes the power and effectiveness out of their leadership. So that's really the heartbeat behind what we're trying to do, engage in the book. And I know from having listened to your podcast a bit, this is something that you all care about and are trying to live out in your own lives.
But I like the point that you just made about making people happy. There's something to be said for what you're saying. If if you're going to stay on track, if you're going to build this kind of like consistency in ministry, yeah, you have to be able to stand up to the buffeting of other people's opinions and the things that other people desire to make them happy. Do you see that, Andrew, in your church context? I mean, are you part of that leadership structure where you feel buffeted by those kinds of things?
Absolutely, Johnny. You know, so I pastor it's a multi-ethnic, multicultural church. We've got people from nations all around the world. And of course, it's hard enough when you have a single culture you're ministering to sort of agree on, well, are we going to do hymns or are we going to do contemporary or what are we going to do?
Sure.
Well, multiply that by several hundred when you got people from all over the world and everybody's got an opinion. And not only that, they're strong opinions. And not only that, but they're pretty sure the opinions of the people from the other cultures are just incorrect, probably demonically influenced.
Oh, jeez.
And then I'm supposed to help lead that. So it really takes differentiation of self. We need to be differentiated on a day-to-day basis, but when the crisis comes, which, you know, as we all know, comes for everybody usually multiple times over the course of someone's ministry. And when that crisis comes, often the undifferentiated person just really collapses. They can't make it because they are so sort of wrapped up in pleasing other people. And I see it all the time personally. This book very much comes out of my own perception that this is where I really need to grow as a pastor, as a leader, if I'm going to be effective.
Guys, is there a fine line between differentiation of self and arrogant selfishness? What's the difference?
I certainly think there's a fine line. It's this unique blend. Sometimes I communicate it this way. We have to care and not care at the same time. It feels paradoxical. I need to care deeply and passionately for the people that God puts around me. And yet at the same time, I need to not care about the shifting praise of those people, right?
Yeah.
I need to not have who I am as a person rooted on other people's opinion of me. I need it rooted in who God has made me to be. And if I can get really comfortable with who I am and my strengths and in my limitations, recognizing that I have a created self that God has formed, He made me that way, I need to be comfortable in my own skin. And the reality is when I do that, when I can get to a point where I'm not as clinging to the opinions of others, I actually can care more for those people.
Yes. You know, I actually think it's differentiation of self is really the polar opposite of arrogance. Even though when you first meet a really well-differentiated person, they can maybe kind of strike you as a little bit smug because, you know, they don't seem so worried about what people think of them.
Yeah.
But the reality is they're the most humble people of all. They're the kind of people, I think of the Romans 12, 1 and 2, where, you know, getting to that point of being able to offer up kind of everything as a sacrifice. You're willing, you got your hands open and you're willing to let God direct your heart in whatever way He wants to direct it in. Well, to get to that point, you really need to be freed up from everybody's opinions. And so I actually think differentiation of self is kind of the, I guess you might call it the soil for real humility to grow.
I'm listening and I'm thinking to myself, yes, I could see how the two seem related, but then at the end of the day, how they're actually opposite. We're going to have some listeners right now who are trying to figure out if they're differentiated or not. And some of us, I think all of us in some way, lie to ourselves and we assume that we have it more together than we actually do. So can you describe for me what the ministry looks like? What does the person's church look like, their ministry look like, for someone who is not differentiated? So that if somebody's out there trying to take their temperature right now, they can get a picture and an idea.
Our book, we're not going to reveal much, but we're kind of taking an extreme case in our book, and it follows the story of a fellow named Peter. He's a pastor of a medium-sized church, and he is not differentiated. And in the very opening scene, we find out that he is actually trying to commit suicide. His wife and his best friend, another pastor, are trying to find him to stop him before it happens. And now suicide is kind of we took it to the extreme, and we made up the story. This isn't a real story, but it's extreme, but it actually happens. I'm sure you guys have encountered lots of pastors who've been brought to a point of suicidal thoughts, suicidal feelings, because of just the crushing nature of ministry. So a non-differentiated person, not that everyone who's not differentiated is contemplating suicide, but there is often a non-differentiated person, there's a panic that rises up in them when they consider all of the pressures in ministry and all of the people they're going to displease. I've heard pastors say, and I've felt it myself in my own pastoral role, where, you know, well, let's see, I know I'm going to displease somebody today. I know someone's going to get ticked off at me. So is it going to be this person or is it going to be that person?
Sure.
And a non-differentiated person can't handle that reality, that there's going to be people that they're just going to displease. And they're inwardly crushed and often feel that panic rising up inside of them as they consider that. Now, in the case of our main character in this book, he's contemplating suicide. There's several people on the church board who are mad at him. There's several other influential heavy tithers who are mad at him. He feels like he's caught in this no-win situation, and he's desperate to get out. He feels like suicide's the only option for him. An analogy I use early on in the book here is, let's say you got a ship's captain. Let's say there's an accident at sea and the ship goes down. And even though the captain's supposed to go down with the ship, for some reason the captain was rescued from the ship. Now, he's suffering not only because the ship went down, but he's also suffering because his identity as the captain has been obliterated. It's been destroyed. He can no longer confidently call himself a ship's captain because he failed as a captain. His identity as a captain has been ruined. So it's sort of this double whammy. Often us pastors, we have our identity wrapped up in our success as a pastor. So when there's a implosion of ministry for whatever reason, we're not only suffering because of that, we're also suffering because this disaster says something about us. It says something about our identity. We often go down with the ship because we can't handle the fact that on our watch, these terrible things happened.
That's scary for me to even think about how many pastors out there could be in that situation right now.
Yeah.
And how many pastors would not even be able to recognize the multiple layers and the multiple levels of stuff going on there. And they're kind of caught in the riptide, and they're being pulled out, you know, and they're swimming like crazy, but they don't understand, you know, you swim to one side or the other, right? Not toward the shore. And they're just, they're hurting. So what would you say to a pastor who realizes, you know, there are these leadership forces and influences going on in my church right now? You know, we're heading into a new year as we record this. We're toward the end of 2016, and there's maybe new leadership coming in, and there's new plans and goals for the new year. Where does a pastor even begin to sort this stuff out and be able to understand what's really going on beneath the surface in the leadership relationships in his church?
Yeah.
And I know there's not really an easy answer to that question.
No, there's not. I mean, one of the things we talk about in the book is, first off, a pastor's got to be really honest about where his or her stuck places are. Once he or she can honestly acknowledge, okay, I'm stuck here for whatever reason. I'm stuck right here. I'm stuck in this relationship with this board member. I'm stuck in this relationship with this parishioner. I'm stuck in this relationship with this major donor. I feel trapped. I don't know what to do about that. Just acknowledging that they're stuck, it is the first step. And then you kind of, if you can pull back and sort of say, okay, so I'm stuck. Now, why am I stuck? What is it that terrifies me so much about displeasing Mrs. Smith? What's so awful about the possibility that the Johnson family is going to leave the church? Why does it just keep me up all night to think that, you know, this young person running headlong into, you know, more trouble, and my counseling efforts have not worked, you know? So asking themselves, well, why is that there? Why is that keeping me up? So those are probably the first couple steps, you know, just acknowledging that you're stuck and acknowledging and trying to figure out why. What is it about it?
Here's a question for you. Say that a pastor wants to put through this new initiative, and he's got this plan, and he has this conviction in his heart, right, that this is the thing for the church, and he's going to go, and he's going to do. And then, you know, any change is going to come with consternation, right? But, you know, he's got his conviction. So this is twofold now. What is the line between callousness and differentiation? Yeah. Because I'm an 8 on the Enneagram, whatever, and apparently that means that I can just kind of like roll my ideas right down the road, and it doesn't matter that you disagree. Like, it's not really going to hurt my feelings. I don't think I'm super differentiated in that. I think that sometimes there's just a callousness. I got to check myself. Yeah. So what's the line between that? And then what's the line between caring for people and capitulation, right?
From my understanding, a lot of it comes down to trusting in the sovereignty of God. So let's say there's a person you've been doing pastoral counseling with, and you know every pastor's been has experienced this. That person just can't get out of their darkness, and the darkness, in fact, seems to be getting worse, and they seem to keep making worse choices that get them more and more stuck. How does a healthy non-differentiated person, or sorry, a healthy differentiated person, how do they not get so swept up into that darkness that they're the ones losing sleep and they're the ones so troubled? From my understanding, is it's a surrender to the sovereignty of God. Frequently, God lets us get into stuck places only to show us that he's the only one who can get us out of those stuck places. And many times, I think a lot of our pastoral counseling situations where it seems like there's no hope, God's really letting us feel stuck so that we can surrender it to him and say, God, in your sovereign love, you're going to have to be the one to get this person out of it. Another question I hear a lot, my wife is a therapist, so she asks herself this question a lot. Am I working harder than the person I'm trying to help? And that is usually a very telling answer to that. If I'm working harder than the person I'm ministering to, that's kind of a sign that person, they're not really necessarily benefiting from all your care and love. And that person needs to come to that crisis, that personal crisis of, oh God, only you can lift me up out of this pit. And they're not there yet.
Yeah, when you care more about their success than they do, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that doesn't work. Did you touch on the difference between caring and capitulation? Is that what you were just talking about?
Caring and callous versus callousness, caring and capitulation. My understanding is the more differentiated I have grown, the more caring I can actually be. And the reason I can be more caring is because there's more of my heart freed up to actually care. If I'm not differentiated, I'm always sort of freaking out of like, oh boy, this is going to be a hard one. Here's one of those extra grace required situations. And I start kind of putting up all the defenses, and I start trying to think, how do I get out of this? I find it to be really helpful when I can, you know, sort of figure out my stuck place, pull back a little bit, entrust myself and entrust this other person into God's sovereignty. And then my heart is a little more open. There's a little more room there for actual caring.
Okay, that's good. That's good. Go ahead, Justin.
Yeah. I wonder too if we need to overlay a couple elements in this conversation. One is the threat of self-differentiation. There also are just different personality styles. You know, Johnny, you were describing your approach to kind of just moving things forward and how your Enneagram style influenced that. If you layer into that conflict styles, right, just broadly speaking, you've got people that err on highly confrontational versus trying to keep the peace at all cost versus that sort of collaborative approach. Ken Sandy in his book labeled it peace faking versus peace breaking, rather than striving for being peacemakers. So some of it is just knowing ourselves stylistically. How do we approach difference? How do we approach conflict? By the sounds of it, Johnny, you know, your temptations would be more on the peace breaking side than on the peace faking side. But up here in the Minnesota nice world, we're probably going to be, you know, our problems are going to be on the peace faking side. Yeah. And we've got to layer those elements into the differentiation conversation.
No, that's good. And I think that that's helpful for pastors who are trying to figure out what they want to, you know, what they want to accomplish and where they're at. To know moving forward, if these are the pitfalls that I'm most likely to step into, right? How is differentiation going to impact me and help me away from those?
Justin, you're talking about personality styles. How do personality styles inform how a person engages in thinking through and adopting a healthy differentiation of self?
I have really strong convictions that my leadership of others begins with healthy self-leadership. So there has to be attending to what's going on in my own life, good self-understanding. Where am I at in my relationship with Christ? Where am I at in my own personal formation process? So some of it is just taking time to do that self-leadership type reflection. Where am I in this process? And then I'm freed up to be able to consider, how has my personality been shaped? You know, you got to go back to nature, nurture kinds of conversations. Some of it's just how we're hardwired. But there's a lot of family of origin stuff that begins to kick in and shaping how we relate to other people. And I think that's going to mean that for some, differentiation of self is going to come a little more naturally. They're used to having good boundaries in relationship with others. I think for people that grew up in, for instance, in family systems that did a lot of triangulation of relationships rather than just talking to people that you have problems with, that's going to be tougher. There needs to be more intentionality of saying, hey, I have more anxiousness that I need to attend to, because self-differentiation is all about, you know, maintaining this non-anxious presence, learning to respond rather than react. And for those for whom that is difficult, it just takes some intentionality to acknowledge where there's anxiousness, acknowledge where there is a kind of a discomfort with conflict, pressing into that, finding some peers in our lives that can walk with us on that journey, learning how to make progress in our own differentiation. In the book itself, we talk about three spheres of embracing who we are as in our created self, embracing our recreated self in Christ, and then embracing our self in relationship. And these three elements are the pathways where we're encouraging people on how to nurture differentiation when it hasn't been there.
Oh, so much stuff, Justin. You know, when my dad, here's my dad's philosophy of being a person and being a leader, and this is what he taught me. This is almost the entirety of what my father taught me of how to deal with any situation.
I'm ready to take notes.
It's three words. It's easy. Here it is.
Oh boy.
Here it is. Be a man.
I knew you were going to say be a man.
Be a man. That's what my dad's. So,
oh my
you know, you get into a situation, well, be a man. Dad, could you get a little more descriptive on that? No, he wasn't any more descriptive on it. Although I have to say, I give my father a lot of credit. He lived out a lot of empathy, a lot of compassion, a lot of conflict resolution, especially in the last 30 years of his life. But I remember, Justin, writing down five words maybe a dozen years ago when I was thinking about leadership, and I wrote, I must lead myself first.
Yeah.
So in order to be a leader, I knew I had to lead myself first. And then I went through some years of trying to do that, and I kept running into these brick walls. And what I didn't understand is that before I could lead myself, I must understand myself first.
Yeah.
And when I went to Bethel in 2010, you know, they've got these assessments that you're supposed to do on the way in to get kind of a benchmark, a baseline. And they found out that I was certifiable and maybe shouldn't be in pastoral ministry. No, none of that. But I remember coming into those assessments and realizing, oh, my goodness, this is why. Oh, this is why I do this, or this is why I'm like, this is why I struggle with these things. This is why I have a problem with these type of people. I didn't understand any of that stuff. So what you're talking about is self-awareness, self-assessment, understanding. You talked about family of origin stuff. Mm-hmm. I remember the first time I heard that phrase, family of origin. I thought, well, what does that mean?
You thought, you know, who cares? Be a man.
Well, be a man. But we're already Homo sapiens. Is that maybe the origin of like species? Or what does that mean, family of origin? So some of you that are listening hear this term family of origin, and it literally just means, you know, the family you grew up in, right? And and then the family each one of the your parents grew up in, and all that stuff. So how do pastors not feel overwhelmed if they've never taken any assessment in their life? They don't even know that there's four personalities and that they probably have more of one than the other three. How could you encourage pastors, as you've written this book, that there is hope for them to know themselves better and become better leaders?
Yeah. And a lot of it really comes down to just asking yourself the really simple question, well, why? Why did I just react that way? It doesn't even take a lot of rocket science or even a lot of self-assessments. Jeff, I remember when I took those assessments at the beginning of seminary, I remember walking into that thinking, oh, I bet I'm going to score really high on the emotional intelligence bit there. And I came back with a very medium score.
Oh,
and
boy.
Thought, I guess I have a little more learning than I thought. I think anybody, though, even if they haven't been through seminary, anybody can ask themselves, well, why? Why am I reacting that way? Why, when she says this, do I have such a strong reaction? Or why when this happens? Or why when, you know, this particular initiative I started flops, why do I feel so much anger? Or, you know, just asking yourself, well, why is that there? You might not figure it out why it's there, but simply asking increases your self-awareness.
That takes me back to Psych 101. Where Dr. Hess, who looked remarkably like Alfred Hitchcock, you know, he would walk back and forth across the room, and he asked the question. He said, "Class, why do we do what we do?"
Yeah.
And I remember sitting there saying to myself, "I have never asked that question before. Mm. Why do we do what we do?" And that's essentially what you just said. We just got to start by asking, why am I the way I am? Why do I do the things I do? And that begins the journey of self-discovery.
Yeah.
There's so many tools and ways to go about having personality conversations. You know, Johnny mentioned the Enneagram, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners are familiar with Myers-Briggs or the DISC or StrengthsFinder. And, you know, there's just different ways to get at you know, either personality or our styles of engaging other people. And I find a lot of value in those. I encourage those kinds of conversations in our leadership classes at Bethel for people to get to know themselves better. But really, if I had to pick one conversation to have that gets at the core that helps me lead well, I think you guys are settling on the right one in your podcast by doubling down on this self-differentiation conversation, because it gets into what are healthy relationships about. And when I understand differentiation of self, I think it makes me a healthier husband, a healthier father, a healthier a teacher and professor, a healthier person to engage in the church. It's helpful on all of these fronts. So if you got to pick something to focus on, I think you've landed in a great place, Johnny and Jeff.
Definitely.
You know, as we're talking, it's dawning on me. I don't want this to sound negative. A person has to want to be better.
Yes.
And how many of us, and how easy is it for us to say, I am who I am, love it or leave it. You know what I'm saying? And is there something, and I bring the USA number one thing just to be ironic, but then I think, is there something about the American spirit almost that says, I am who I am an island, I am, you know, going to be a man and define that how I want, and you guys have to just deal with it. How do we encourage pastors to begin to want to be something else? You know, Justin, you talked about being a better father. I have a 12-month-old, an 8-month-old, a 3-year-old, and a 6-year-old. Wow. And I see myself beginning to react to the 6-year-old and the 3-year-old, you know, why don't they get this and why don't they get that? And I'm, you know, getting frustrated, maybe yelling, and I can feel myself, and I love my father, but I can feel myself starting to react the way that my father would have reacted to me.
Oh,
my,
yeah.
My wife says, you know, here's all this research about the brain. Here's all this research about how kids think and how the, you know, the brain operates and all this. And she says, you know, if you make a game out of something, or if you play with your kids, you can diffuse a situation before you get into it. So I'm trying to do these kinds of things, right? I want to be a better dad. Like, I don't want to get into, like, fights with my kids. But you have to have that desire first and foremost, right? How do we encourage people? And Jeff, you like to say, if they listen to this podcast, they already want to be better. But I mean, do you see that as an actual problem, that there are people who don't want to get better and they're the ones who are ruining it for the rest of us?
I think you're absolutely right. You know, people have to want to get better, and there's a lot of people who don't realize they need to get better or don't really want. The thing I need to say about that, though, is unfortunately, for those of us who are pastors who have entrusted our lives into God's sovereign hand to shepherd us as he pleases, really often the thing that wakes us up is pain of some kind. You know, pain is supposed to be an alarm signal, you know, but we do all kinds of things to medicate that pain so we don't feel the pain. When we have pain in a relationship, that's there for a reason. And like if we have pain in a, you know, our marriage, we're not trying to assign fault yet or assign blame at this point, but it's there for something. And often it's only pain that gets people to ask, how can I be better? I wish it were something else, but.
And I wonder if I can jump in on that pain point, because that's actually a bit of the seeds story behind how we ever launched into this book.
Okay.
So another colleague and I, a guy who teaches actually in a business school in the South, his name's Chris Howard. He and I have done a lot of research together. And one of the articles that we published did a study looking at what were some of the factors that developed leadership resiliency in people's lives. So our hypothesis was, people who experienced obstacles and hardship along the way in their life were actually going to be more resilient leaders. But
sure,
we want to test that hypothesis. So we got things such as you know, the Connor Davis resiliency scale, and then we grabbed another instrument that measured self-differentiation, and we asked people those questions in light of a number of events in their lives, kinds of developmental experiences and relationships, assignments, training, that tried to get at not the easy stuff of life, but some of the more challenging stuff that happens in people's development process. And we found a very positive statistical relationship between these hardship elements, these obstacles, and leaders who demonstrated more resiliency. So, you know, as we dove into this study, it caught Andrew's eye, and, you know, we worked together at Bethel, and he was a TA for me for a while, and we've been friends since. And he said, hey, guys, you know, I think what you've talked about here around resiliency and self-differentiation needs to get beyond just a scholarly audience. What do you think about targeting a book towards pastors? And so we're telling that story, but the seeds of that story is really the place that the hard stuff in life has in developing us into the type of leaders that the church needs.
Yeah, I completely agree with you that, you know, people who have not been through hardship, they have they're just only so deep. You know, if you haven't been through suffering and through hardship, you're only going to get so deep. And I agree with that, and I've been saying that for a long time. It's kind of one of my encouragements to people who are going through tragedy and suffering.
Yeah.
Is that, okay, well, since you're going through it, there's really good stuff to get out of it, since you're going through it anyway.
Yeah.
You know, don't go through it and not get some of these golden life lessons.
So often when we're in pain, our very first instinct, even as pastors, is how do I get out of the pain versus what is one of the treasures I can dig out of this mine. I'm stuck down in this dark mine. Is there a treasure I can dig out of this? Yeah. But instead of asking that, our first question is just how do I get out? It's unfortunate missing that kind of opportunity.
I recently preached on that within the last 10 years. And I use the wash cycle of a washing machine to illustrate that. You know, you get in and then you start agitating and and then you go through the rinse cycle and it's not fun, and you want to jump out of the process, but then you got to go through the spins. I mean, you got to go all the way to the end, and then you're clean and you're ready to go in the dryer. And face the heat. Huh. But, you know, when you're done, you're ready to be put on and to be worn. And don't jettison out before the process is complete. Justin, let's transition to what you're doing with the DMIN program there at Bethel. And this conversation, by the way, that we're having on differentiation of self, self-awareness, leadership, leadership resiliency, this is going to be an ongoing conversation that I know Johnny and I are going to have with people like you, Justin, and like you, Andrew, that have done work on this. And, you know, if you're listening and feeling like, boy, you know, I see there's something here. I don't really know how to get after it. Start with the question, why? You know, why am I the way I am? And don't be afraid of the answer.
Yeah.
Do not be afraid of the answer, because God created us the way he created us, and we've all been through different stuff, but God is going to use us from where we're at and moving forward. So why do I do the things I do? You guys at Bethel Seminary prepare people for ministry. You've done some things with your Doctor of Ministry program. Justin, you want to talk about that?
Yeah, happy to do that. Maybe I'll just step back and one quick big picture comment, maybe for those that are not aware about Bethel, but at our master's and doctoral level programming, we approach education what we call our three centers philosophy. If for folks that went to seminary, you know, I went in the early 90s, so you know, you think the 90s or before. It often was just you know, getting really good with your biblical exegesis and theology, and maybe throw in a preaching and pastoral class, and you're good to go. But it really didn't give a lot of attention to the personal formation, nor did it give attention to leadership kinds of discussions. And so Bethel has been responding in recent decades to say we need to have solid biblical and theological foundations, but we got to layer onto that personal and spiritual formation with leadership effectiveness, and how do those three elements work together. So that's true for our Doctor of Ministry program as well. We're trying to nurture those kinds of conversations. It provides a place for people who have been out of school for a while to come back, have a little bit of a checkup, engage with other people who are dealing with sort of mid-career, mid-ministry questions, and diving into learning together. And we have a self-directed program that engages church leadership and congregation and family care. And what we're really excited about is in our cohort offerings, we actually are launching a fully online program. We're among two seminaries that are the first ones to be approved by the Association of Theological Schools to offer it, where, you know, folks that are serving out in churches who for whatever reason, for financial considerations, transportation considerations, don't want to travel to a campus periodically, they can do a Doctor of Ministry in Transformational Leadership fully online now, starting this coming summer. So we have a number of offerings, but we're really excited to announce that.
So when you say cohort, what do you mean by cohort?
Well, a cohort is when you are engaging in your classes both with a common set of students as you move from class to class, but also in our Doctor of Ministry program, we have a cohort mentor that works with that group of students as they walk through the program as well. So it gives a continuity of the learning experience as you're journeying through those classes, both in terms of that faculty mentor and also the common students that you'll work with throughout those classes as well.
So the cohort is like a group of students moving through it together.
Exactly.
And what size, what size would a group be? what a cohort.
Well, our master's level program cohorts are around 15 people, but in our doctor of ministry program, they're typically anywhere from a half dozen on up to 12 to 15. But we run our doctoral program smaller usually to allow a little more rich interaction that's taking place in that cohort context.
When do the on-ramps happen for the Doctor of Ministry program? Is there certain times of the year when you start that?
Yeah, this is really the sweet spot right now. Our biggest entry point tends to be in the summer for pastors that are coming to intensives. And so getting registered or working with the admissions department up till about March is a good time. But with the online program, we have people that will be entering in summer semester, fall semester, and spring semester. So currently, we're working towards that that summer launch time.
And how long does it take to get a doctor of ministry?
Yeah, in our program, you're going to take about 3 years for coursework. It goes at a little bit of a slower pace than our master's programming, so you're not packing in quite as many credits into that time frame. But it's doctoral level work, so it requires a bit more intention. So 3 years of coursework, and then another year to plan on for that dissertation thesis phase. So 4 years is usually the minimum for people.
So if you wanted to get started to get your doctor of ministry, if you've already got your MDiv, your master's degree, there's no time like the present. I remember telling my wife, okay, I'm 47 years old. If I start now, I can, and this was for my MDiv, I said, I can get this done by the time I'm 52. It seems like a long time, but when I'm 52, I'll be happy I started when I was 47.
Absolutely.
And when I was 52, I had already been done for 9 months because we hurried through the program. I got done when I was 51. Mm-hmm. So, hey, no time like the present. That length of time may seem like a long time, but you need that much time, right? I mean, Justin, we need that much time to learn and grow through the process of that kind of a program.
That's great. Yeah, and you know, if anybody wants to chat more, they can go to Bethel's website at seminary.bethel.edu and kind of track through the website and find out more about the Doctor of Ministry program there.
And what, just to give a ballpark figure, if you were going to do that new online deal that you've got going for the D-Men, what's the total cost for something like that going to be, or maybe even just the yearly cost?
Yeah. Kind of comparatively between our self-directed programs and our cohort programs, they range between around $18,000 to upwards about $25,000. The cohort programs are a little bit more expensive than our self-directed. So if you're an economically minded person, you can do your DMIN for under $20,000. If you want a little bit more of a learning-rich environment, that is around $25,000.
So if you're just doing it online without going to campus, can you still be involved in a cohort?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. We, in fact, that's part of our working with our accreditors was to ensure that the students going through our online experience would have rich, simultaneous kinds of interaction with faculty, with their fellow students, and with on-site ministry mentors as well. So it's not just you can't think about online education as sort of a mailing in for people to send back the DVD or CD with learning units.
Right.
This is real-time interaction that people are having either asynchronously through things like discussion forums or synchronously through joining together on things like Google Hangouts or Adobe Connect. And, if those are terms that are unfamiliar to people, you'll learn about them as you enter into the program. But we do some real-time interaction. And so it's not just sort of learning from the sage on the stage of a professor, but kind of engaging with these fellow learners as you walk through the process as well.
So if you're in your 40s or 50s and you think of an online degree as like the old mail order type lessons and things like that, cassettes or worse yet,
yeah,
VHS tapes. Hey, this is a 21st century type of an education. And don't be afraid if you're in your 40s or 50s or even 60s to go for it. I mean, you don't want to get too crusty as you enter your 70s and 80s. You know, this could give you that rejuvenating jump start into your later years where the wisdom really starts to rack up. So again, that's seminary.bethel.edu.
That's correct.
That's very cool.
And Jeff, you're mentioning multiple life stages. We had a graduate who recently finished. He started his DMIN program, I think, when he was 77 and graduated when I think he was 81 or 82. So,
oh, I love that.
No time like the present. And, you know, it's about being lifelong learners. I have three graduate degrees now. Part of it's just I like learning. But I recently went back for another master's here recently after my doctoral work. And, you know, it's just, there's just something helpful about staying fresh, continuing that learning journey. And, you know, it's not about titles at this stage. So, you know, yeah, it's a doctoral degree. The doctor of ministry is. But it's more about just making sure that you have some best practice knowledge to serve the community that you're part of.
Absolutely. Very good. And Andrew, is Andrew still there?
Yep.
Do you want to throw in any kind of an affirmation on the Bethel programs?
I'm so glad I did it. I'm so glad I did the MDiv. I am continuously drawing upon lessons learned while I was there. And while I was in seminary, that's really where I started learning about differentiation. And so it was sort of a combination of God. I was in a lot of pain, actually, and God used the lessons that I was learning there to help give me wisdom for kind of growing in that season. So I would recommend more education for anybody.
That sounds really great. So guys, make sure you tell us when that book comes out, and we're gonna let our listeners know. I love this. You've written, Andrew, some of the narrative in the book, some of the story of the pastor. You can't call it a fable, right? It's not the fable
right.
part. But it's a narrative about pastors that are actually going through this self-discovery and self-awareness process, differentiation of self, and then there's also chapters in there that are more didactic, more teaching.
Yeah, so, pretty much every chapter has a blend of narrative at the beginning to introduce some points, and then the didactic element that comes alongside to complement what was just shared in the story.
That's so cool. So we look forward to that coming out. Hey, guys, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
Obviously, we will keep you posted when that book comes out, because we'll be the first purchasers of it, and we would like you to get it after. But we actually have a book right here on the desk today, don't we, Jeff?
We do. And this is a book that I had to read a couple of years ago by a guy named Steinke.
Jeez.
I mean, it's just...
You know, there's a dance move named after this guy.
Steinke?
The Steinke leg.
Is it really?
Well, it's the,
is there re-
it's
I mean,
the
is Steinke there really?
Leg, but yeah, why not?
Oh, okay. Well, Peter Steinke.
Yeah.
It's Stein, S-T-E-I-N, with a K-E after it. So Steinke, I guess.
Yeah.
Congregational leadership in anxious times.
Okay.
Being calm and courageous no matter what.
This is the whole thing. This is the whole thing, is be a non-anxious presence, right? Be a non-anxious presence. Don't let the anxieties of others latch onto you like barnacles from the seafloor of anxiousness. How's that for a picture?
I like that.
And don't.
I'm about ready to ship you off.
Don't spread your barnacles onto others. We have to be non-anxious. The anxieties of others can't affect us. The anxiety of the system can't affect us, because when it does, we become like a disease spreader, and anxiety is the disease.
And it's bad when we are, when we're spreading the anxiety,
right,
or we're taking the anxiety and we're multiplying it.
Yes.
Now, all this, listener, what was it, Pastor
Mike,
Linda?
Mike and Linda or something like that.
Mark, Pastor Mark and Pastor Linda.
Yeah.
All this is easier said than done.
Always.
Easier said than done.
We'll go back a couple episodes to the me and you talking about this in our own relationship.
Right.
Yeah, it's hard.
I was in a conversation recently, and I started to get worked out. The person, hey, don't react. And I'm like, yeah, don't react. I just sat back, took a few deep breaths. But man, I was reacting.
Yeah.
So it's easier said than done. But this book, I mean, is a follow-up. Go on to Amazon, get it however you want to get it. Congregational Leadership in Anxious Times.
Yeah, grab a copy.
This would be really helpful for you if you're finding yourself in need of this kind of stuff, of what we talked about on this episode.
I think a lot of pastors are. I mean, let's just
I do too.
Brass tacks this thing. This is a hard place to live in, and we all need a refresher course on it. And so I think every pastor could benefit from books like this, like the one that Justin and Andrew have coming out. I'm going to tell a quick story, and then we're going to get out of here. My 3-year-old, right, he does this thing where he gets all worked up. He's three, right? You could say he's getting anxious. And he'll say, I need you to help me calm down. And he wants us to hold him and shush him and things like this. It's like he knows he needs to regulate, and he comes to us for it. I came home the other day, and he says to me, Daddy, today I helped Mommy calm down.
Oh, boy.
He had done something, and my wife was like, what in the world, Asher? It's like, and he said, Mommy, I'm going to help you calm down. It's okay. Calm down. Because that's what we're always telling him. So anyways, even three-year-olds can help us regulate and be non-anxious presents. You, don't react, even to your three-year-old.
You tell your three-year-old, if he needs help calm down, you send him over to Uncle Jeff.
Oh, boy.
Uncle Jeff will give him a little help calming down.
Oh, boy.
I'll give him a little help in the seat of authority.
Jeez Louise. Well, we hope you've been encouraged up until that note, and we'll sure have Justin and Andrew back on in the future. I'm confident of that, and we'll see you next time on the 200 Churches Podcast.
We hope you've been encouraged and inspired by this episode of the 200 Churches Podcast. If you haven't already, subscribe at 200churches.com and receive the guy's free PDF download called Our 7 Favorite Ministry Resources. You can count on us to be back next Wednesday with another brand new, shiny episode just for you. Until then, may God bless you as you lead and love the people in your 200 church.
Okay, so when we're, I are a public speaker.
Yeah. Yeah. There's, how's that for another point for you?
Be going. Oh, I'll
end. Okay.
You know, when we talked about doing a podcast, okay, well, what do we do a podcast about? Well, you know, any church podcast is going to be, you know, Andy Stanley,
yep.
Rick Warren.
No, we got nothing. We can't compete with those guys.
Stephen Furtick. You know, these guys are talking about their churches of thousands.
Mm-hmm.
And
sure.
All pastors listen to them, and 80% of churches, you know, are under 200 or so.
Right.
And so you got all of us, you know, 80% of pastors out there are listening. It's like me watching a pro bowlers tour and then going to the bowling alley.
Yeah,
I'm gonna be disappointed. You know, it's like the little league player just listening to the major leaguer talk about, you know, how to play.
Right.
It's apples and oranges.